Accession number 27305, real one.
This is an interview with Flight Lieutenant Simon Brailsford, recorded by Rodney Giesler at RAF Lynham on December the 13th, 1993.
And if I talk, that should give you a nice sound check, or does it just do it automatically?
It's an automatic level anyway.
Great.
So, can we start off by your date of birth and a bit about your background and...
Flight Lieutenant Simon Brailsford, born on the 12th of April 1965, was educated at a then grammar school, had seven O-levels, failed two of my four A-levels, failed miserably to get to university, and it was suggested that I went along to the RAF Biggin Hill to attend an interview for the Air Force, just so that I'd have some interview experience. If I was to go anywhere else in the world, I'd have one of the best interview experiences that I could get. So I duly got on the train, went down to Biggin Hill, and was successful to be accepted for pilot training. I then moved on from Biggin Hill, joined what was then called Flying Selection Squadron at Swinderby, and went through the 15 hours chipmunk flying that you have to do to work out whether you can actually fly planes or not.
Yeah.
That was after officer training at Cranwell. Once through Swinderby, I went and held in Germany for 6 months as an administrator, just while they sorted out courses. I had a bit of a backlog then, as they do now. And then from there, I joined Church Fenton. I went through 7 months of flying training on the Jet Provost. Found out I wasn't very good at flying the Jet Provost, and they told me that. And once duly chopped from training, I then elected to become a navigator. From the very
did you get solo time on a Jet Provost?
Yes. I got to about 107 hours, so I got quite a way through the course. Just struggled through the last bits. I always wanted to fly Hercules right from the day I went to Biggin Hill, because it seemed like an operational real job, even though it was peacetime and whatever it was doing was real. It wasn't training for anything. If you're carrying cargo and you're carrying troops, it's cargo and troops, whether you're in training mission or a real one. So I always felt that was a bit more front line than just doing training sorties around England and wherever else in the world. Went on to Finningley. I started the navigation course. I did 4 months of navigation, and then contracted a bad infection of my inner ear, and then was grounded for a year. So I then, thinking that this was the end of my flying ambitions completely, joined the public relations office at Finningley and spent a year very profitably engaged in marketing the Battle of Britain Air Show at Finningley for the then first year I was there, and then subsequently the next year. Expanding it as it happens to all the radio stations that had not been tapped for the advertising potential that they could give. So a very fulfilling year on a job that I didn't really want to do, I hadn't joined to do, but was just left in. I then got back into the nav training, went to another year, and I was then posted to RAF Lynham in 1988, which is 4 years from when I actually joined the Air Force.
The actual nav training, I mean, presumably the course included not only potential Hercules navigators, but Tornado.
Yeah, everybody at Finningley starts off, they are streamed in a basic stream, and then depending on how good, bad, indifferent you are, you are put through what was then, it's changed now, Group 1, Group 2, Group 3. So you could go fast jet, you could go helicopters, or you could be sent to Group 2, which is the transport world. But if you were a good Group 2 navigator, you'd go to Nimrods. And if you were an average Group 2 navigator, you'd go to Hercules. The pilot or ex-pilot community who go through Finningley generally have a bit of an advantage, because they have done the first 15 hours at Finningley anyway, but they've flown it themselves. So all of a sudden you're faced with, I don't have to fly, so I've got extra capacity, therefore they tend to do quite well. So the majority of people who go through Finningley or went to at my time, who were ex-pilots, tended to go on to Tornados, or Buccaneers or Phantoms as they were then. Subsequently, they've all moved on to Tornados with the demise of the old fleet. My thoughts were never on fast jets, and I made that very clear from day one at Nav School, and I was given a bit of an attitude problem all the way through because I wanted to fly on Hercules. Fortunately, my scores were good enough to go fast jet, and I didn't want to go fast jet, so I was streamed Group 2 through choice, and was told that I would probably end up on Nimrods because I was top of the pile in the Group 2. I didn't want to go Nimrods, and I put my foot down and said I didn't want to go Nimrods, I want to go Hercs, and ended up on Hercules. Posted to the OCU here in 1988, as I said, and then before that, in fact, I actually went through the Group 2 phase where you have to learn to do astro shots and you have to learn to do DECA handling, which has now gone out as a navigation, and all the old style, real art navigation tools that you need to do transport fleet flying, as opposed to the computer industry flying of Tornados and weapon systems analysis and all the rest, which is what the fast jet boys do. We do the OCU here. We brush up on the specifics that we'd learnt at Finningley, the specifics of the kit in the plane, which when I joined here for 5 years ago were in fact the old analog wheels. The Decca had just been pulled out and revamped to an Omega, and specific nav tools which are now fleet fit here but still do not even approach a computer aided navigation, which is why we still have a navigator rather than a weapons operator on the Herc.
So you don't do sat nav on the Herc?
The sat nav has just come in. We do have it now. It's a selective tool. It's easy to buy off the shelf, but the Air Force can't afford it at the moment. So we still have to do the old style timing, analog wheels, watching the kit carefully. And it justifies the nav's existence at the moment. I suspect in another 5 years you'll find that navigators don't exist on fleet aircraft, just like they don't in civilian trade, because your black box at £100,000 takes all the guessing out of it, doesn't talk back, and gets on with navigation, a very precise solution.
Well, when you're flying around Europe, I mean, do you use the civilian VORDME system?
Yes, we use all the normal civilian nav aids. There's no difference. The only difference is that the navigator will back the pilots up in every approach they do, so that should the day happen when all the VORs, DMEs are switched off, as it did in Granby during the Gulf War, the nav can competently talk down the pilots to the best of his ability and get them into an airfield when sometimes the civilian airliners might not be able to. At the moment, it's a very big trade-off because the civilian airliners have got very sophisticated internal navigation systems, which we haven't got yet, and that's why they keep us.
Presumably, I mean, there are, you mentioned Granby, but there are fields you go into now that are dead electronically anyway.
Yes, yeah.
And what, you've got to go in VFR, presumably, haven't you?
Yes, we do. You have to maintain VFR below safety altitude, as any navigator would do. What we do now is we operate very close run with the pilots and the navigator, and you'll pick a ground feature, and once you've actually got a fix before you go for your approach to an airfield, you'll update your kit, set it to an expanded mode that means you're operating in yards rather than half miles, and we end up talking the pilots down just like a PIR controller would, except you haven't got your radar picture of you going down the slope. It's very much a map, distance, height comparison, and easing him into the wilderness.
Presumably, I mean, you do quite a mixture of flying. I mean, not only the sort of cross-country supply drop type of flying, but also straightforward airline, you know, flying out to Cyprus, for instance, to Akrotiri or something like that.
Yeah, what happens at Lynham is there's a very definite trade-off between the route flying and the tactical supply flying. And what happens when you get to Lynham is you'll spend 6 months learning the trade, and you'll do your inland airways routes in Europe, just like the normal civilian air traffic would. You also do going across the Atlantic, which is a big thing in a navigator's eyes, because there's no VOR, DME. He has to do astro fixes. He has to use a Loran, Omega, to get fixes from. And we'll go across the pond, inverted commas, get our ticks in the box to say he's done a across the pond sortie, he's done a inland airways in Europe, he's been to America, he knows about the rules and regulations of America. Might have been up to Greenland, might have been down to Australia, might have been across the Indian Ocean. And in fact, I was lucky when I started here that I did. We used to have enough money around then to be able to justify going and training around the world. So we used to say, right, set up from Lynham, the embassy in Tokyo needs resupplying. And it was then, this is 5 years ago, more sensible to send the Hercules from here, because it was part of the British budget, full of the kit for the Tokyo embassy, and we used to get training value out of it. So we used to land at international airfields from here to Tokyo, spend 14 days away, route stopping, overshooting various airfields, so we'd made an approach there. We'd seen what was on the ground, we'd seen how difficult the air traffic was to understand. And when we get to Tokyo, we'd deliver what we had for the embassy there, which is our purpose, our task, and then we'd fly back a different route, taking in different airfields, taking in different continents, in order to establish proficiency in actually flying in different worldwide environments. I specifically remember in my first 6 months on the squadron, we flew around the Gulf. This was two, three years before the Gulf War. Nobody expected that we'd be in the Gulf. Nobody expected we'd be there with no nav aids and nothing. And so when we were actually deployed out there for the first time, it didn't come as a very big shock, because we'd already been training there, we'd already been to the airfields, we knew the environment, we knew how hot it was going to be, we knew the limitations of the aircraft. And all these things weren't steeped in any mystery, because it had been done before. I suggest now, if your Tokyo embassy wants anything, it charters British Airways cargo, and we don't get any training, and it saves the government perhaps a couple of £100, because they have to justify it on the accounting side. So things have changed just in the last 5 years, massively on the new monetary management system budgets, and we don't get the training and don't see these places, and so the next time anything happens, you'll be...
You've got to go in cold.
Going cold. And because there's less money for training here, you've probably less chance of actually being ahead of the game. You've got to be a little bit more with your wits around about you now. So you do your first 6 months on the squadron.
Yeah. Can I, before, this is interesting, before we leave this long-distance flying that you did, presumably... It was the kind of navigation you really wanted to do, which made you go for Hercs
No, it wasn't. No, it's one of those things like any good tradesman has to do his time. The long-distance navigation for me is very tedious, it's very precise, it's very studious, and you have to fill in your log. And in fact, we use the same logs as the Lancaster navigators used during the World Wars. It's exactly the same principles, exactly the same fixing techniques, exactly the same. Nothing has changed for 40 years.
So you still had to work out position lines by the old tedious system?
Exactly the same. And for me, that wasn't exactly what navigating was about. My idea of navigating, particularly because I was an ex-pilot, is something more like you're in the seat, you make a decision. If you make the wrong decision, you stick by your decision until you're proved wrong. And when you are wrong, you admit it and you go in a different direction and get yourself out of the trouble you've just got yourself in. More seat-of-the-pants stuff. But by nature of the fact, when you start doing low-level tactical flying, is what you have to do. You can't sit at your table and draw a position line, because it's happened by then. So the long-distance flying was worth its weight in gold to me. And it is for every navigator on the fleet here at Lynham, because you do your trade... You learn the basics, and it gives you something to fall back on. It's always that fallback that you need. It's just experience, really. So you're confident in your own ability to achieve a time, to achieve a place, to achieve a letdown, to actually tell the pilots exactly what you want them to do.
It's really knowing old-fashioned arithmetic in case the batteries in the calculator go flat.
Similar, yeah.
In a way. A
similar analogy, yes. Yeah. The route flying in itself had its bonuses, because you get to see the world, which you'd never really have done at the age of sort of 22, 23. It's an opportunity that you can't miss out on, or you shouldn't. I mean, everybody should have an opportunity like that. But it does put the ground rules firmly in their place. It makes the building blocks for you to move on to develop your skills as a more sharper operator. There's such a big difference between route flying and low-level flying that if I was to say, now we've got the two route squadrons and we've got two low-level squadrons at Lynham, the route squadrons are a lot more perfect in the way they fly their routes than the way we fly our low-level. But then they would say we're a lot more perfect in the way we fly our low-level than the way we fly our routes, because that's our speciality and that's our bread and butter. And when we go to do the other bit of the trade, it's something you perhaps haven't done for very long. It's something that perhaps you are rusty on because you haven't been back there for a long time. And so everybody has the polish in their particular area. So generally everybody does 6 months. And then if you're on a route squadron, you'll continue just doing routes all over the world. I was posted to 47 Squadron, which is a tactical squadron, along with 70. And because I was on 47, I wanted to be on Herc, so I was enthusiastic. I was given a low-level course quite early in my career. I was told to get on with it, and as such went low-level flying after just under a year on the squadron, which is the normal run of the path.
Can you tell me a bit about low-level flying and low-level navigation? We've talked a lot about some long-distance work now, the different techniques and the heights you fly at, and
yeah, sure.
Sort of demands on you, if you like, as well.
Low-level flying is all about planning, and right from scratch you have to plan the sortie so that at any time during that sortie you know what's going to come next. You shouldn't have left any stone unturned when you're in the planning stage, so that if something does come up that is nothing to do with your sortie, you're ready for it and you're ahead of the game. And the fast jets do this very successfully, but then they fly it slightly different than the Hercules does. The actual sortie profile would usually take, for a normal 2 or 3 hour sortie that we do, we would normally end up flying 250 feet over the UK. In some areas of the UK, obviously these heights have been bumped up because of public opinion at the moment. To digress slightly, the Gulf War, there was no low flying complaints for about a month after. And all of a sudden now we have thousands upon thousands. And then we see atrocities like, John Peters, for example, and everybody says, oh, there is a need for low flying. But nobody really pushes it to the public, and they therefore complain like mad when we go low flying, even though we're training for not to get shot and not to come a cropper. We normally do 250 feet. There's some areas of Britain at the moment that are still dedicated low-level areas, which means we can actually fly down to 100 feet in, given permission, given a workup training, which is more akin to what we'd be doing real-time in a real situation. And I'll talk to you a bit later about our experiences in Bosnia, but we've had to do that a couple of times for real reasons, and I'm glad that I've had the opportunity to fly low-level and experience being at 100 feet when you have 60 foot of wingspan at each side. Concentrates the mind a little bit. We fly 250 feet. What we're trying to do would be to incorporate a small drop, which is a bundle out of the door. We try and incorporate a larger medium-style drop, which is where the cluster packs would come out of the back of the aircraft and deploy onto a drop zone. Or we do very big, heavy-stress platform drops, which incorporate things like Land Rovers, big fuel packs, any heavy instrumentation that needs to be delivered, field gun, for example, that needs to be delivered on a drop zone. And we'd practice dropping one, two, or three, or all, if we could, as part of our trip around. And we use Salisbury Plain Training Area. There are several DZs, drop zones up there. The Army...
South Cerny, I've seen you go over.
South Cerny, yeah. They man those, and we fly over those as part of the trip. So, a lot
these
of...
heavy loads, have they got parachute retarders on them?
Yes, yeah. We just we have actually got a new system now, which is called ULA, which is called Ultra Low Level Drop. And the ULA drop is at 15 feet. And instead of it retarding, what it does is the parachute deploys behind the aircraft and literally pulls the load straight out of the back. So your forward speed, you're going forward, the parachute deploys, and if you can imagine, the aircraft continues forward and the internal bits, i.e. Land Rover or fuel pack or whatever, is on the ULA platform, just gets sucked out of the back and it drops on the floor, slides along for a little while, and is ready to use.
And the platforms presumably have shock absorbers built into them to a great extent.
The load inside them is designed so that it's it destructs to a point where it's ready to actually use once it's hit the ground. They're all tied on very nicely, and it's all rigid frame stuff. But from 15 feet, it's no drop at all for a Land Rover. It's like driving off a mountain road, I suppose. Yeah, so we do those sort of drops. And then what we also do is we practice night flying on the normal squadrons, and we practice at 500 feet above the highest obstacle, bearing in mind what nav aids we have, how far people can see. We'd do the same sort of sortie profile with the same sort of loads, and we'd fly around at night visually again with 3 and 5 mile safety heights, depending on how much kit we got going for us. And that's just another facet of the training in the low-level environment. Another thing that was extensively used during the Gulf, which we hadn't practiced so much then, but we do now, is practice temporary landing zones, TLZs, which have been done for years and years in Dakotas and all sorts of things. Particularly recently, when the Gulf was on, we had to go and land on rough, semi-prepared strips. This is all the squadrons at Lynham, in fact, the Rich squadrons as well. And so everybody had to start training quite hard to be able to talk themselves out to land a certain distance away from the threshold and be prepared, if they didn't make that certain distance, to overshoot straight away. Because the rough landing strips aren't that long, there isn't enough room to stop, and if you miss the box where you're meant to land, you have to go around off it. There's no choice. Whereas on a major runway, you wouldn't normally have that problem. But particularly during the Gulf, smaller strips needed some practice. And that then brings the co-pilot into talking heights, talking distances. The navigator will get integrated in the same patter, and we'll find that the aircraft will hit the spot, be able to be stopped, unload the goods, and then get out of there as quick as possible. So that's something that's come up just recently, really.
On these low-level sorties, I mean, presumably it can be a pretty bumpy ride, can't it?
Yes, I'm not the best traveller in the world. And certainly the pilot normally concentrates on poling the aircraft. He's hands-on most of the time, unless he gives it to the co-pilot for a small while. The co-pilot will be map reading visually out of the window, and he will be pointing out objects ahead, at the side, and steering towards turning points, which we've decided. My job would be, effectively, to act as a memory bank for him. He tells me when he is 1 mile left of track, 20 miles to run to the next turn point. I've also got a map, and I can look out of the window and back him up. But if the weather's particularly bad, I don't need to back him up, because what the pilot will want to know, as soon as he can't see anymore, is where the high ground is, where his safe climb-out lane is, what his safety altitude is. And so, all the time the co-pilot is giving me information, I will look after where we are, I will make sure the kit is exactly where we are, so that not only will I know how far it is and what timing we've got to keep and what speed we need to make good the time point, but I'll also have to my fingertips, if the weather starts getting bad, where to climb, how to climb, heights to climb to, whether there's any airspace that we shouldn't be going into above us, whether there's any mountains to the side of us we don't really want to go into either. And I'll have all that at hand all the time we're doing the trip. And so he will, once the bad weather starts, it actually integrates the three a lot more. When it's very good weather, the pilots really could get on with it themselves. I would be the first one to say that we're integrating three people. It lightens the load, and come the day of the revolution, or has happened before, when things do get very, very fraught, you can take one man out of the loop to deal with another problem, and it leaves the other two to get on with the flying, and it's the flying that's going to save you. So,
do you encounter things like wind shear at those heights?
250 feet? Well, we do, and we do fly. We tend not to fly unnecessarily low. If you can imagine, if you're going around Ben Nevis, there's no. The only reason for flying low is to avoid AAA, anti-aircraft artillery, radar-guided anti-aircraft artillery, or surface-to-air missiles, whether they're heat-seeking or radar-guided. And so we're practicing low level to avoid being detected by radars and avoid being shot down in the real case. So if you're behind Ben Nevis and there's a radar at the other side of it, there's no point in being 3,500 feet down on the other side when all you need to be is just behind the peak, because that will stop you from getting shot and stop you from being behind the radar. So the turbulence factor, it's just good airmanship not to get in a situation where you're too low and there's too many big mountains and it's too bumpy. We can offset the turbulence by speed, we can offset the turbulence by moving away from the mountain, we can offset it by climbing a little. So we don't religiously fly around at 250 feet just because it's there. We are doing it for a very sensible reason. And normally the turbulence, it does get bad, but you learn to live with it. It's like if you're first in off a period of leave, if you go and fly, oh, I won't be feeling the best in the world after a three-hour trip at low level. Your body just accepts it and you get used to it. The next day I'll be feeling a lot better. Day three, back in the game again. It's just one of those things that you learn to accept. And everybody has their own tolerances, and everybody gets back into the swing of things at their own pace.
Just like seasickness, really.
Exactly the same.
Yeah.
Although, I don't think it's quite as severe in a plane. Some people would argue that.
It doesn't last as long,
no.
Anyway. Right, so, is there anything else to cover low level now? Because what I'd like to go on to ask you is... specific operations you've been on, you know, on supply drops and so on, are those operations that you can tell me about?
Certainly, at Lynham, there is a competition, a worldwide competition, called Airlift Rodeo, and I was quite lucky in that my progress through the squadron was timed quite nicely with the competition that's held in America every year. In fact, it's every year, and it's an international airdrop competition. And so I was chosen to go on Airlift Rodeo in 1990, which is no bad thing because it hones your timing skills down to 1 or 2 seconds. So you can drop a load on a drop zone within a 5-second window. It also means you should be able to carp the load so that when you release it from the plane, it lands exactly on the drop zone. It's something we didn't cover before, but it's a system that's been used from DC-3 days. And effectively, if you can picture as you drop the load, as it goes out of the back of a plane, the load will be travelling the same speed as the plane, so it has forward direction. As soon as the parachute deploys, it will have downward direction. And then as the parachutes take up the wind will carry the parachutes and the load to where it needs to go. So you have to reverse the picture mentally, so that you're dropping it at a certain place, so after it's travelled forward, after it's travelled down, and after it's travelled maybe sideways or backwards based on where the wind is, it will land on the cross that's been put out for you to land it on. So you have to work that all out in the air as you're running up to the actual drop zone.
You're really navigating the load.
Yes, yeah. So you're a ballistics expert for the last 2 minutes. We didn't really cover it, but most of the sorties will involve a 40-minute call before, so that the loadmaster can organise it down the back so that it's ready to be released. 20-minute call to become action stations and ready. 10-minute call. And then at 4 minutes, I'll have worked out where it wants to go, how it's going to go out, speeds, heights, where the wind's coming from, which side we're going to drop it on, so that I can guide the pilot. And at 2 minutes, we're then ready. The doors come open. 30 seconds, we're all ready to go. And at 15 seconds, I am actually away from my desk and visually spotting where the actual load has to go on the drop zone.